Chapter XXVIII. Again we come to you with our love from Venus. Yes, it is quite true our sister, Ruth, has discovered in her own way through her vision, that we are Shambhala, or should we more correctly say, part of Shambhala. We here in Azure are one of seven such cities and places. Each one of these cities is directly related to your earth plane in a certain separated type of spiritual service. We, in Azure, function with those who have passed on from the flesh in some form of maladjustment, such as the soldier boys and sailors, the suicides and murderers, and their victims. The other cities relate their activities to equally well-defined fields of spiritual and physical therapies. It is my plan to go into these different cities and, just as we have done here in Azure, make an exploration and find out more fully their own particular capacity. You must remember these seven cities are all on the same relative plane of spiritual concept and are not to be confused with our brothers in the lower orders of Venus. Sufficient at this time, however, of this particular subject. While this transmission is worthy of everyone's attention, it is directed particularly to all Earth doctors, and their allied and associated sciences. You have in the past 100 years made many noteworthy and commendable advances in the field of medical science, as it is related to mankind. However, there is still much to be done. There are many very apparent gaps in your sciences and philosophies. There is still a host of unconquered diseases. I could mention a few of these, such as cancer, epilepsy, Berger's disease, multiple sclerosis, dystrophy, etc. Any doctor could add a long list to these. I may say to you truthfully that none of the conditions will ever be conquered from the physical side of life. You, who are medical men, have as yet limited yourselves entirely to the physical body and material mind. You have not yet realized that man is spiritual and that his physical body and mind are only outward expressions of the spiritual self. I will create for you an allegorical equation. If you had been, long since birth, in some obscure remote corner of the globe and were entirely unfamiliar with the civilized world, and could not speak its language, if you were then transported to some city and set down in front of a television set, you would quite naturally assume that the pictures came from inside the box. You would have no way of understanding the concept of transmission of electrical impulses from the transmitter. You would quite likely, in your curiosity, try to tear the box to pieces to see where the pictures came from. This is exactly your present position. Just like the uneducated person, you are still hoping to find the solution for the unconquered conditions in the human body within its own physical structure. You will keep on looking until the end of time and you will not find the answer in the body. As I have said, the condition so incurred is reflected from the spiritual or psychic mind and body. Picture, if you will, the lawn in front of your home, which has a sprinkler system. When you turn the valve, the water spurts up through nozzles at regular spaced intervals. This is the lifeblood of your lawn and it would quickly die if it did not have it. So it is with the physical body. Each tiny atom that is the basic substructure, for every cell depends on its energy source, not from the food consumed into the body but from the psychic self. This psychic self is, as I have explained, the sum total of all man's many lifetimes. Each person or patient must thus be viewed and diagnosed, not as the sum total of this lifetime, but from all the lifetimes. I know this is hard for you to visualize, but so were the pictures in the box, for he who did not understand. Because you have no measurements or instruments which can determine a psychic self, does not mean it does not exist. It means that you are merely ignorant of the fact. I have explained in previous transmissions that the psychic body, existing, as it does, in another dimension, is not subject, in a common sense, to some of the predetermined relationships which you have established. You cannot see it or sense it because, in your lack of concept, you have not developed the sensitivity. Roughly speaking, the psychic body contains all of the experiences, the negative and positive conditions, and all the other sundry happenings, which have occurred in the individual's life for perhaps many thousands of years. These experiences and happenings are contained as millions of tiny waveforms which revolve in miniature vortices which in turn compose, in a similar equation, what you might term the molecular structure of the psychic body. As you have all agreed that, generally speaking, all incurable disease conditions that reside outside the contagious pathogenic realm are incurred from wrong thought habits, as the mind is only an outwardly reflected concept of the sum total of all experiences. It is therefore logical that such cures must come from within the psychic body. The psychic body is linked to the physical body, not only through the mind, but similar to your sprinkler system. You have a number of psychic centers or contacts in your physical body which directly transfer the life-giving energies which come from, and through, the psychic self. These centers are located in the solar plexus, and in the center of the forehead or pituitary, the extreme ends of the spine, the soles of the feet, and the palms of the hands, etc. These psychic centers reflect energy directly into the atomic substructures. This energy is the glue which holds the atom in an adhesive intelligent pattern. The atom, in turn, is a miniature counterpart of the numerous vortexes of waveforms which are in the psychic self, except, of course, that in the physical body, the atom is in a physical dimension. You have a basic understanding of what you term psychosomatic medicine. You believe that many of the small negative fears incurred in childhood become the nucleus for a big neurosis as an adult. This is quite true as far as it goes, it just doesn't go far enough. Each individual must, in your diagnosis, include any and all previous lives. As you know, often in discussions with patients, if a certain negative happening of childhood has been recalled, a partial and sometimes a complete cure is effected. This happens to only about 50% of the patients. If you could recall to the patients the negative happenings in his previous lives, you would get at least a 98% average of cures. The therapeutic action which revolves around such a cure from a mental disturbance has, as its basis, a very fundamental concept. Picture, if you will, a circle, and that this is the life cycle of the individual, and that at a particular point the negation was incurred, if it can be relived or recalled, in a mental way, at another particular point of this cycle, it will bring into play certain opposing dynamic forces which will cancel the negative quotient of the experience. The two different points of occurrence and dissipation may be widely separated in the evaluation of your earth time, such cures, or dissipations, being more effective at certain relative points. These are, of course, factors of harmonic relationship. Now I know that up to this time no earth science of medicine or psychiatry has developed a doctor who can so diagnose a person's life. Heretofore such a practice has been confined to a relatively few and in an occult sense. You have one outstanding demonstrator of clairvoyant diagnosis, who lived until quite recently, in your modern world. His name was Edgar Cayce. For your own benefit, you would do well to read some of his many case histories. Here again, however, as he was practically alone in his understanding, there has been as yet no developed or general understanding in the medical profession, either of his work or any others who have so expressed themselves. Let me say at this time that, just as hundreds of years ago, comparatively little or nothing was known of your modern techniques, so in the future, when the ultimate solution and cure of men's illnesses is found, no longer shall practices be confined to the physical realm, but shall be an integrated concept of physical therapy and mental clairvoyance. The future doctor will not only be able to diagnose the superficial physical manifestations but will also be able to relate them to all of the patient's five previous earth experiences which have happened in his many evolutions and lives. I am touched somewhat with a feeling of gladness for my brother who is about to make an ascension, and it is a sacred and holy occasion, one which we do not distemper with sadness. Soon now you shall enter in with us to help us in the ceremony where he will depart for a higher realm, but until then, rest in peace. Malvar. Chapter XXIX. My greetings to you, brother, and to my brothers and sisters on the earth. I see you have already arrived and are sitting on the bench in the temple garden where we had our last discussion. While you have been gazing at the wondrous beauty about you, you have also been watching the numbers of my people who are going into the temple, for the hour approaches midday when our beloved brother will make his ascension. You have already anticipated the identity of this brother as Shatok, who gave you a transmission in my absence. Because of your somewhat as yet undeveloped familiarity with our ways and customs, you did not know that his beloved mate who is our sister Urza was also making the ascension with him. While we sometimes enter into this highest plane of existence on Venus as a single individual, yet is very soon that our true mate makes his or her appearance. Just as the birth of Urza will, in a few days, be duplicated by the birth of her beloved one. I will not take the time to discuss more fully the relationship of the two genders, as I have already discussed this somewhat in a previous transmission. But come, the hour is close. We will walk up these three steps which lead into the large arched doorway before you. These three steps have the meaning or interpretative significance of man's three states of consciousness. As the whole temple is built upon these three steps, they reflect, first, the lowest step is the carnal nature, the second step is the mental nature, and the third step is the spiritual. This is also sometimes called the triad. Now we will enter the doorway. We will step aside and pause a moment while you get accustomed to all that is before you. While the overall pervading radiance within the temple is extremely bright, your eyes are becoming accustomed to it, and you are beginning to see more clearly what is before you. As you saw from the outside, this is a large circular enclosure and around the outside circumference there are three rows of benches. These are already almost filled by my fellow Venusians. However, I see you are much more interested in the central portion. You are wondering at seeing something which somehow seems to remind you of an astrological earth chart. The large double circle, which is about 50 feet in diameter, is composed of the purest red crystal. This crystal circle extends above the floor by about 1 foot. Around the outside edge of the circle is a wide band of the purest white crystal. The division is further emphasized by what appears to be bands of a golden-colored crystal. At certain regular divisions, this circle is divided into an equal number of segments by a line of pure blue crystal. In the center of each section of the white strip is a symbol which looks amazingly like the familiar astrological symbols. This entire circle is the basic astrological chart of our planet Venus. The Earth people have misconstrued the basic meaning of these symbols by referring to them as animals. This should not be done. The signs themselves are symbols which relate to certain controlling forces by which the planets are ruled, something like the chemical symbols of the Earth scientist. Each planet has its own number of divisions. The Earth has 12. The planet Venus has 13, and so on. Each planet therefore reflects in a direct proportion some, or all, of the elements of these controlling forces. You will begin to see that there is a reason why so much confusion exists in the Earthman's interpretation of astrology. 100,000 years ago, or more, he was taught this true concept of astrology. But coming down through the thousands of years of time without the personal guidance of some of the more masterly intelligences, he gradually warped and distorted these basic astrophysical concepts into something he could, in his Earth mind, compare more easily, just as your Earth scientist today knows very little about even the basic concept of transmission of energy from one dimension to another. He has been struggling for many years to evaluate the sun's energy and how it travels through the millions of miles of an apparent vacuum, as heat. It is not heat, neither is the sun hot. As I said before, the sun transmits energy from one dimension to another, just as the wheel of your auto transmits the energy from the motor to the road. There is, shall I say, a huge cosmic motor, or better a spiritual motor, which is connected to the sun. How this is done I will not attempt to explain until you have further grasped the idea of dimensional energy transference. The energy, as it is reflected from the sun, is not heat or light until it comes in close contact with the earth. There, in the strong magnetic and static fields, and with the combination of atmospheric friction, it is transformed into heat and light. All of you have seen a snowy mountain top, and while you were sweltering in the valley below, the snows remained cool and eternal. The farther up you get from the earth's surface, the less and less is the energy transference. If you could go up far enough, which many aviators have partially done, the temperature would drop to below zero, absolute. Beyond the ionosphere, as you call the protective energy shield, you would have to alter your entire concept of the values you have assumed on the Earth's surface. The Earthman of today is planning space travel by rocket propulsion. He is trying, through the means at hand, to evaluate what the conditions of space travel will embody. He has many surprises coming to him, but may I say, as time is short, that he will never accomplish space travel until he has learned more of the laws of energy transference. Even your weatherman is amazingly inaccurate in his predictions. He has not arrived at the point where he can see that his weather conditions are entirely the net results of the movement and behavior of the extreme high-frequency spectrums which I have called the magnetic fluxes. The weatherman should know that the weather fronts, of high and low pressure, are all induced by tides of magnetic fluxes which move in a vast array of structural lines, not only around his Earth, but throughout the entire universe. Getting back to the temple where we were describing the circle, you will also notice a large square cubicle of pure white crystal which is standing in the center of the circle. On one side, which happens to be closest to you, is a series of seven golden steps made into a little stairway which connects with the top of this cube of crystal from the flat surface of the circle. Above the cube, in the center of the dome-like roof, you will also see that there is a ring of large discs of pure crystal, each one of a different color. Each disc in its color is directly over the symbol, in its respective segment of the circle before you. Now the time of the ceremony is here. Although there has been no sounds which you might normally associate with a large gathering, yet there still is an even increased sense of silence. After a few moments you will again hear some of the peculiar very pleasant sing-song music of energy that you heard at the birth of Orda. Now that you are listening to the music, watch in the space above the cubicle. You will begin to see what appears to be the vague outline of a tall flame. It is not a yellow flame as you might see on the earth. Now as it grows stronger and becomes more apparent, it is beginning to take on a wondrous beautiful radiance of countless colors. It has grown to the height of about 10 feet. All of the minds in this room are helping create this flame. There is also a projection of radiant energies through the 13 crystal lenses which are focused exactly on the spot where the flame is resting with its base on the crystal cubicle. Now the flame has assumed such proportional brilliance that you are almost blinded, and Shatok and his wife Urza have made their appearance and are moving slowly, hand in hand, toward the seven steps. Shatok is tall and straight. His hair, a flaming mass of gold, falls about his shoulders, and while he has been here among us for about 2,000 years, his face is young and youthful. Urza, too, is very beautiful. Her hair is of a copper-red color. She, like her mate, walks straight and erect. Her beautiful features are unmarred by lines of age. Both Shattuck and Urza have their gaze fixed upon the flame. They do not look around. They do not appear to be sad or frightened, nor are they. Within their minds are pulsating energy currents of aesthetic love. They are in tune, and are part of the pulsating mind of God. And now the slow ascent up the stairway begins. At the top they pause, just before the flame, then arm in arm they step into its pulsating radiant energy and are gone. Gradually the singing voice of energy dies down, and as it dies, so does the flame. In a little while all is as before. Slowly my brothers and sisters begin their exit from the temple. Their faces are not filled with sorrow. Instead, each one reflects some of the radiant beauty of the energy which they have helped direct. Each mind is filled with a new courage and a new measure of inspiration. Each one has rededicated himself or herself to their consecrated service of their fellow man, and so in the coming time we shall not forget Shattuck or Urza, for they shall come again among us from time to time, though we shall not see them quite as they formerly were, for they have ascended into another realm which is almost beyond our vision. Urza and Shattuck may come to us with others in our future days to teach new truths, to give us new inspiration and vision, and thus, my friends, most you also do likewise. Know not the fear of that which you call death, for death is the separation of the physical consciousness and means only liberation into a higher realm, and with each succeeding graduation do you ever approach and draw closer to the fountainhead of God. Malvar. Chapter XXX. Greetings again, brother and sister. We here in Azure have been observing some hours of meditation and contemplation since the departure of our beloved brother Shattuck and our beloved sister Urza. I would say a word here too, for she likewise has ascended in the seven evolutions through Shambhala to the ascension. As I have been looking in your minds and sorting out your thoughts, I see that you have been rather excited about putting together some pieces of evidence which has caused you to believe that Shattuck was the man called Jesus, who lived on your earth 2,000 years ago. Now that you have come so close to the truth, I believe it is only fair to give you more definite information. I have carefully weighed and evaluated the chances of this information being a bit disconcerting to some of the earth minds who will read these lines. Yes, Shattuck was Jesus. It was not coincidence that you and Sister Ruth were all part of a carefully chosen plan whereby we could clear up some of the mysteries of Shambhala, as you were both living in the Holy Land at the time of Jesus and, as you know, were very vitally connected with the crucifixion. Through your participation, as a channel for this expression, it was much more easily accomplished. The man Jesus, at the time of his birth, came from the planet Eros asterisk. Asterisk planet not yet known by Earth astronomers. It was this bright, very highly evolved, planet which shed its shining rays in the early morning hours of the birth. It was on this planet that the Master, Jesus, went through a series of evolutions, where he learned the secrets of higher powers which, in his Earth life, enabled him to perform the many miracles. As I have said, the great ones on Eros are quite highly advanced, so much so that they can guide their planet through the universe wherever they wish to go. There are, however, many abstract concepts in the evaluation of the various positions which man evolves into. These might be called adepts, masters, or lords. In the infinite concept they are not so called, but they assume a certain relationship which expresses its own quotient of infinity in the whole structure of the universe. We, here on Venus, who understand these truths, do not evaluate ourselves by assuming any position other than that which relates to our particular service to our particular planet. Thus it is with the seven cities of Shambhala, and while each city has its own particular relationship and function in the service of mankind, yet all have the same general appearance. Many Earth people, including a few who live in your modern times, have caught glimpses in psychic moments of these cities. So while they all generally agree somewhat as to their general appearance, Apparently no one knew, nor were they given information that there were not one, but seven cities. In our explanation of Azure, we have only seen a small fraction. As I have mentioned these seven cities which comprise Shambhala, it is also only fair that I give you more information. However, the subject here is very broad, and could easily cover a number of volumes, but a short digest will give you something of an idea. These seven cities are functioning like Azure, in their own individual expression of their capacity to mankind, on numerous Earth planets. The seven cities, while they are all on a somewhat similar spiritual level, are on seven different planets. These are spaced like a belt around our particular galaxy or star cluster. Thus they can serve not only Earth but a large number of similar planets. There are other planets which also serve the lower orders of humanity with Venus and her six sister planets. Each has a particular way in which service is rendered. One serves in the field of philosophy. We serve in the art of healing and adjustment. Others serve in fields of political and other types of leadership, poetry, music, and kindred arts, science, religion, etc. As in other cities, we have large galleries with exhibits which depict the entire history of mankind in his evolution through the various planetary systems. There are also laboratories where a student can go and learn all the scientific arts which relate, in their innumerable numbers, to the expression of life on these numerous planets. It would take you many years to explore our city alone. There is one more point which I would like to clear up in the ceremony of the ascension you witnessed. While it was performed in the large central temple, this was especially done because of the high position of Shatok and Urza. Sometimes, however, the ascending individuals may choose to use a more private way. They will thus make their ascension in any one of the small altar rooms like the one which we saw at the birth of Orda. However, in each instance of ascension, whether it is in the central temple or in one of the small altar rooms, the process is the same. Throughout the preceding chapters and our various discussions, I have attempted to give you not only a word picture of our planet and our city, but I have also tried to bring you some of the more important elements which will enter into your future lives. Whether or not this will be of any value will depend upon each individual. In God's great universal world, there is no one who will stand over you with a whip, neither will we turn our backs to you when you need help. The important thing to remember is that your progress or your evolution or whatever you get out of life, whether here or hereafter, depends upon your own attitudes. No one with a closed mind gets very far. Your book of life is written with your own hand, and all that you will see, because they are the things which compose your spiritual body. It is logical to assume that these be of a nature which can live and function in a world which is a part of God. It is with great reluctance that I must write the final lines and speak the last words which will bring this book to a close. Now I say to our beloved sister Ruth and brother Ernest, that you have indeed rendered a great service for which we are grateful, and although these last lines are being written, it does not mean a termination of our contacts. In some future time, we will again return to you in this capacity and new volumes will be written, as they are required by the seekers of truth. I further appreciate my own personal opportunity and that I was granted the opportunity to speak as I wished. If there are some doubts or questions as to any of the information, please feel free to send the thought and we shall add to or create new chapters, as you see fit. My only regret is that we could not further explore our city at this time, but, as I have said, we shall do that together sometime at some future day. So with all our love, may you prosper and find the fullest measure of God's eternal love. The Venusians. Poem by Dr. Ernest L. Norman as follows. Man goeth about the earth, and there is much knocking and grinding. Likewise there is great haste unto the end of nothing, and that man findeth in the pain and anguish of his own doings, and with the knocking and the grinding and the great haste, he shall find the emptiness thereof, and that he shall cry out against the emptiness of all of this, and that surely he has wasted his life. And I say unto you that, though he is all of these things, in many lives, that he is long-suffering, yet surely he will not slacken, neither put aside all these things, until he seeth only with the Spirit, and heareth only of the Spirit, and that verily he speaketh with the voice of Spirit. For surely now he is all of these things of Spirit, and so becomes as one with God. Addendum, a word from the channel. It had been my original intention that as a channel for this book I would remain unheard and unspoken. However, in view of two recent national announcements, I have been prompted to add or point up several of the more vital and pertinent issues contained in this book. And while these issues have been quite thoroughly and adequately covered, yet I believe what I have to say will not go amiss. A few days ago, our government announced it was planning to build the long-dreamed-of space satellite. They had hoped to project some sort of rocket which would travel in an orbit around the Earth. Almost immediately on the heels of this announcement, Russia also announced similar plans. It is quite obvious that, while these two similar projects were loudly acclaimed as scientific projects and inspired for the sake of pure science, behind it all was the same old militant ulterior motive. And so again it has come to pass that two nations are extending their right hands in a gesture of friendship and peace, while in their left hands they clutch the weapons of war. It should be equally obvious to the leaders of our nation that after thousands of such wars and peace treaties, this too will come to naught. True peace will only be attained in an absolute concept of brotherly love, and in the perception and conception that all mankind as individuals or collectively, have their own way and right to live. Back in 1945, the Second Great World War was brought to a sudden, dramatic, and ghastly climax by the explosion of atom bombs over Japan. It can be said that these explosions ushered in a new atomic age. It can also be said that it is also an age of fear. Since that time, mankind all over the earth has walked in the shadow of that fear. Not only did the explosion of those atom bombs bring a new way and concept of life to our people, but it ushered in another age. Almost immediately the skies seemed to be filled with strange glowing objects or spacecraft from outer space. In the years following these various thousands of appearances, everyone has become space conscious. Every little boy has had a space suit. He can and does frequently indulge in rocket takeoffs and other things which are supposed to be part of this new science, while as yet man has not, from this earth, produced a craft which is capable of traveling into free space. As in the years following the first appearance of these craft, the world has been divided into two camps, those who do, and those who do not believe in flying saucers or spacecraft. In a certain sense, both camps are right. The great mass and preponderance of evidence, and photographs, which support the appearance of many and numerous types of spacecraft cannot be denied. Nor can we deny the reasonable equations and views of those who do not believe. The truth is that spacecraft have not, as yet, appeared in this third-dimensional world, nor will they do so, for this third-dimensional world, or material world, as we know it, is not conducive to such craft and their operation. In the preceding pages and chapters of this book, much emphasis is given to what is termed space and energy, and the relationship of energy to mass. In the various equations and hypotheses which have, up until this time existed, all have missed certain relative and vital points in their relationship to energy and mass. It has not yet occurred to the scientist that while he has 101 elements, and that they each express in their own way, through the difference of their atomic structures, a relative weight, or a reactive consequence to certain known physical laws. If he thought for a moment, it would become obvious that there were not only 101 elements but perhaps many thousands of other elements, which existed in other dimensions which were not reactive to our physical laws. He has also not correctly evaluated a true concept of an atom. An atom is not a solid particle, neither is it composed of a number of solid particles. An atom is composed of tiny vortexes of wave energies which are pulsating, in outer rings of wave forms, around a central vortex. This whole atomic structure is supported internally by what the scientist calls space. Actually, there is no such thing as space. Space is full. Not with a solid substance or a static substance, but with a pulsating radiant energy. This energy comes from the fountainhead or, as some people say, God. This energy which is constantly stemming from the fountainhead, is also returning. It can therefore be said to be expanding and contracting simultaneously in all directions. This radiant energy is supremely intelligent because it reflects the infinite mind of the creative fountainhead of God. Thus, to be infinite, it must express infinity, and in infinity it must become also finite. So therefore this radiant energy will express itself in countless dimensions and in countless forms. Thus it has done in our material world in our 101 elements with which our scientists are familiar. We also know that these 101 elements are bound and held together in our world by certain physical laws, as they are called. These are gravity, inertia, momentum, centrifugal and centripetal force. There are other laws, of course, which are relative, but of less consequence. These laws are the determining factors in the behavior of static masses of energy which you call elements. The scientist has not yet become aware of the fact that if we change the relationship of the emanating or sustaining life force of the atom, that it likewise changes its qualities and its relationship to the dynamic controlling forces. Many years ago the scientists were pondering about the sound barrier, and thought that an aircraft could not pass through this supposed impregnable barrier. Today, with many, many thousands of aircraft passing through this barrier, the scientist has learned certain facts, namely that an airplane will behave quite differently after passing this certain line of demarcation which he calls the sound barrier. In other words, the known physical laws which govern the elements in his more familiar earth plane at stationary levels have now somehow become altered after passing over this barrier. In the future the scientist will learn that in crossing over the ultimate barrier, which is the speed of light, at 186,000 miles per second, he will have crossed the last known barrier which relates to his physical world. Between the sound barrier and the speed of light, however, he will find many other barriers, or lines of demarcation, all of which change the relationship of mass and his elemental atomic structures to any of the known physical laws. In the appearance of the various types of spacecraft we have visualized that man has, on other planets, arrived at or passed a point, in his concept of science, which relates to the ultimate barrier, the speed of light. Therefore the appearance of any spacecraft in our third dimensional world is not an appearance in a true sense of energy and mass equated from our own standpoint or position. In other words, the scientist in the other world has succeeded in transmuting or levitating elemental atomic structures into a relationship with the energy source, which takes it completely out of the realm of the known physical laws of this Earth planet. He finds then that he is no longer affected by gravity, inertia, centrifugal force, or any other known factor. Actually, these laws are all one and the same. They are expressions of the cosmic energy as a controlling ingredient in the expression of energy as mass on our plane. Therefore, it can be said that the appearance of a flying saucer to some individual, even though he may touch it or go for a ride in it, does not mean that he does this in a true physical sense. He has been temporarily, at least, transported in his concept, to a point where he will somehow meet halfway with this spacecraft. The spacecraft itself has had to come down from a much more highly evolved position into our lower Earth strata. We might compare these things with the chords of a piano. Thus, while we are playing a chord at the high end of the scale, we can also play chords at the lower end of the scale, which are either harmonious or inharmonious with our original basic chord. The flying saucer man must therefore bring his craft down into a level of relationship which is closer to our known physical laws of the earth plane. This accounts for their peculiar behavior, such as the wobbling or the pendulum-like motion, the tremendous rates of acceleration, and their appearance of being glowing, white-hot, or transparent or translucent. Actually, these factors, in themselves, are only relative to the plane which the saucer is in contact with at the moment. In its true state, it is not bound by our known physical laws. So you can easily see that spacecraft have not actually visited our world or our dimension, nor has anyone, in a true physical sense, ever contacted a spaceman or taken a ride in such a craft. I can say this truly to those who have written books or accounts of these contacts, in reading all of the various stories of contacts which have been made by such persons, there has been always one important ingredient lacking. None of these people were in themselves a clairvoyant or a medium. In other words, they did not have the supersensitive development with which they could properly evaluate their position. Now I know that the word clairvoyant is likely to arouse some antagonism or skepticism. Let me say that if you have an open mind, you will start with Dr. Ryan of Duke University, and when you thumb through all the pages of history of the past 2,000 or 3,000 years, including the Bible, you will begin to understand what clairvoyance means. Clairvoyance is not some hocus-pocus thing which is practiced in some dark room. It is a clear-cut science which relates man with the higher and infinite source of his nature. In the inward sense, every man is a part of God, as was pointed out by Christ. The very fact that we exist in material bodies supports this theory. We could not exist a single moment without the supporting force of the infinite mind of God, as he manifests himself in a continual stream of power into every atom of our being. The very life of our body is dependent upon this source. Even the elements which we call food and take into our bodies are dependent in their relationship to us upon the expression of this divine force. So, in conclusion, may I say that man never will and cannot attain mastery over any other dimension than his own until he has mastered the concept that energy and mass, and the product of mass in relationship to energy, can be changed and altered. He must also learn that any or perhaps all of his present-day known physical laws will, in a few years, be discarded. Newton served his time. So did Einstein. There will be others who will come along and give a much newer and greater science, and with this new science will come a new knowledge and a new wisdom which will more definitely relate the consciousness of man with his true inner self. And with this consciousness that he is God, he will lay aside his warlike weapons. He will lay aside his desire and restlessness to conquer space. He will lay aside many of the aggressive militant attitudes which lack the common ingredient of brotherly love, and thus he will come into his millennium, his utopia. It might be well to say that the announcement of the satellite might bring a new wave of appearance of spacecraft, and if you should see one of these, do not doubt what you have seen, because it is quite likely that you have really seen it, but remember that this craft does not, in a true sense of the word, belong in your world. It does not react to our known physical laws simply because the minds who conceived that craft were definitely able to alter the relationship of the materials in that craft beyond the point where they were reactive to even such things as light. They have gone beyond the last of our known barriers or lines of demarcation. They have passed the point of 186,000 miles per second, which is the ultimate concept of our present-day scientists. Einstein tried to evaluate this by saying that such a relationship would assume a compressed effect, as far as matter was concerned. He was not quite aware of the factor of frequency relationship with the infinite emanating source of the fountainhead. This is of the utmost consideration and importance. It will be the basis for the New World Age and the New World Science. An announcement which recently came out of one of our great medical centers, the Mayo Clinic at Rochester, Minnesota, stated they had found that newly born infants just one day old sometimes had the symptoms of cancer. There was no evidence in the report to indicate that such cancer symptoms were inherited, nor is there likely to be any. Another one of the great factors which man will have to learn and consider in relation to himself is the factor of evolution and reincarnation. In the pages of this book you are told how you are a creature of many lives and many evolutions. You are continually revolving back through states of consciousness where you can learn to assimilate and evaluate certain concepts. After thousands of such evolutions you will be objectively viewing God in an infinite number of aspects. And in such viewing, and in such knowledge, you will attain sufficient wisdom to assume mastery over these conditions. Thus you will become one with God. As was explained, a person is primarily not a physical being, but a spiritual being, and he manifests into this world as a product of relationship with his spiritual self. This spiritual self functions through his psychic body, which links him with the supreme energizing force of the fountainhead. This psychic body is composed of countless thousands of tiny vortexes, or wave forms, which can be familiarized to atomic structures, except, of course, they exist in a much higher dimension or frequency relationship. Many of our past occurrences and experiences in past lives are thus deeply embedded in the intricate waveform patterns. Cancer is a product of misalignment with the cosmic motivating force which sustains every atom in our body, and being non-productive becomes destructive in nature, and like many other diseases multiplies its destructiveness. When the doctor or the psychiatrist in this day and age, or some future day and age, has properly assimilated this concept, he will be able to cure cancer. He will be able to cure many of the other diseases now incurable. He will have passed the last of the great barriers which have held civilization back in the slavery and drudgery of ignorance and disease. So, friends, read this book through carefully. It was designed by the great ones themselves, and these great intellects are much closer to God than you and I. It was brought into existence as an expression of divine love and the consciousness of these great beings. And in reading may you absorb the wisdom which is contained in its pages, and though you may, or may not, agree with all of the things which you read, you may rest assured that if you continue to pursue your course, being inquisitive and open-minded, you will eventually understand all that is contained herein and much more. It is quite obvious that, with the great number of subjects which have been covered in this book, they necessarily had to be made quite brief. However, we have been promised a succession of similar books which will go into much more length and detail about the various subjects which have been primarily covered in these pages. But until this time, may you all rest in the graciousness of God's love. Since the publication of the present volume, additional communications have been received, comprising several additional volumes. Addendum. At present mankind is entering into a space age and, in this advent, there is a great broadening in certain concepts and aspects concerning the possibilities of human life lived on other planets in other solar systems in our universe. While such a concession would, a few years ago, be ridiculed, it is today, a commonly accepted fact. And using the newly developed radio telescopes in conjunction with the already existing optical types, the man of science is probing the vast depths of space, trying to pick up any signals which would denote an intelligent race of humans on another planet. This is the first of many steps the Earthman will take before he succeeds in his quest to establish communication in some physical manner with other humans, living on distant planets. As of today, the Earthman scientist is not aware of the fact that communication between this and other planets has been going on for thousands of years. This has been done in three different ways. The first and more universally used method is mental communication, and every human who has, or is living is always telepathically speaking in direct communication with untold millions of humans living on uncounted numbers of distant planets. The second and probably most important means of spiritual communication is spiritual transmigration. During every moment of Earth's history, great numbers of disincarnate entities, people without bodies, are traveling back and forth between various planets, some to be reborn in new physical bodies, others to influence through subconscious auto-suggestion. Third, there has also been, in the past as well as the present, some interplanetary travel in certain kinds of spaceships. Considering the vast amount of interplanetary travel which has, and is going on, even though unseen, and unrecognized by the material Earthman, we can therefore safely present an obvious fact, that Unarius Channel, Dr. Norman, is an interplanetary traveler, but more than one who is motivated by some capricious whim. He is one of the original Lemurians, of which there were 11, and who came to this planet in a space vehicle some 156,000 years ago, and established the first Lemurian civilization. In this respect he can remember and describe life on the planet Lemuria, some 700 light years distant. Since that time he has lived various periods of time in other and more closely associated planets such as Mars, Venus, Jupiter, etc., and is well acquainted with many of the people who live there, and can accurately describe their lives. This interplanetary brotherhood method of communication, travel, etc., is part of the life contained in his works, and again will be vindicated to some extent in future history. As Jesus said, "In my Father's house are many mansions." The great and unending vistas of space contain not only material suns and solar systems as they are known to the modern astronomers, but unseen and unknown, existing in different vibratory rates as different dimensions, are other vast and infinite reaches, all thickly populated with other kinds of planets, composed from energy substances unknown to the Earthman. These are the many mansions, places to be visited and lived in by any and all humans on their evolutionary pathway of life reincarnation, if you please, but always a way in which the infinite lives and regenerates. To an old Lemurian master scientist, the Earthman and his science appears to be more puny, more elemental, and more ridiculous than a group of primitive children playing a jungle game. Yet he is temperate in his judgment, a temperance which has been born through vast millenniums of time, a wisdom acquired by consorting with the ageless and timeless inner dimensions which, like vast dervishes in an endless sea of time, gyrate in infinite number and convolutionary expressions, repeating each regeneration endlessly, for such is the way of the infinite. A knowledge of this infinite is yet to be acquired by the Earthman, and which will supplant his archaic beliefs in demons and gods, an understanding which will relegate his religions back into the dust of his crumbling temples, a wisdom which will give him wings swifter than light, a way to span the vast regions of space in less than a twinkle of an eye, a high road to eternity and a byroad into every man's heart. Ernest Leland Norman, November 11, 1904, December 6, 1971, was an American electrical engineer, a philosopher, a poet, a clairvoyant, a scientific researcher, a paranormal investigator and the co-founder of the Unarius Science of Life, and before starting the grassroots work for Unarius, Ernest Norman also worked for the Borderlands Sciences Research Association as a contributing editor for the Round Robin Journal, and also worked as a minister for a spiritualist church for 15 years. Ernest Norman wrote 20 books in his lifetime about that covered everything from theoretical physics, spirituality, philosophy, theology, extraterrestrial life, sociology, poetry, and he also authored articles further emphasizing the interdimensional science he was trying to teach. The first book he wrote, The Truth About Mars, gives an account where he met the Martian ambassador, a being named Nerel, and traveled to the underground cities of Mars in his astral body. He is referred to as the Unarius Moderator, shortened to the Moderator, or as Drive Norman by his students, out of respect. A self-described genius child prodigy, Ernest Norman never sought a doctorate through academia as he was self-taught and did not have formal schooling for many of the subjects he seemingly mastered.